So as I mentioned, we're going to finish out talking about multiple myeloma. We had a last-minute switch here, and Dr. Loniel was nice enough to join us. So you were in town, dude?
I was. Yes.
Awesome. Incredible. So we're really pleased today to have our faculty here, Dr. Sagar Loniel from the Winship Cancer Institute in Emory University in Atlanta, and Dr. Nupur Rajeh from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Welcome to you both. I think we'll actually just start out with you, Sagar, and talk a little bit about the approach to upfront treatment.
Thanks very much, Neil, and I appreciate the chance to be here. Yes, my medical school classmates decided to have a reunion at Disney, so I
Awesome.
Rode a ride this morning and then came over. So I'm trying to do it all. So what I'm going to spend the next few moments talking a little bit about is developments in the context of newly diagnosed myeloma and what some of the most recent phase three data is that really speaks to this. And many of you guys may have seen this recent approval, really in part based on a trial that I'm going to show in a few moments. But it really all began with the Perseus trial. And as you all know, the Perseus trial was the global version of the Griffin trial. And the Griffin trial was a U.S. randomized phase two trial that basically used the standard of care at that time, which was VRd, single transplant, VRd consolidation, and len maintenance, and compared it with dara-VRd transplant, dara-VRd consolidation, and then dara-len in the maintenance phase. And as you can see here, this gives us a really nice insight into what it means to have dara at every phase of treatment. It doesn't answer an important question that I think I'm sure Nupur and I will talk about later on, which is when. Does it matter when you give it? Does it matter giving it the whole time through? And certainly, if you're a strict constructionalist and follow the outcomes of the Perseus data, then giving it up front and late makes a lot of sense. Here is what we saw from the Perseus trial. Clearly an improvement in overall response rate. And if you look at the whisker plot on the right, almost every group seemed to benefit pretty significantly from the addition of daratumumab. And I remember when I presented the Sirius trial, and some of you may remember the Sirius trial, single agent daratumumab in relapsed and refractory myeloma. One of the things that I said in that presentation is I hope we don't have to relive the rituximab story, which is rituximab plus anything else is better than anything else alone. And sure enough, we have done this with daratumumab. Dara plus pretty much anything else is better than anything else left alone. And so the question is, how do we think about sequencing and how do we think about combinations? But as you can see from that whisker plot, as you can see from MRD data, this really is significantly better for the dara arm. Now, this translates into a four-year progression-free survival in the dara arm of about 84%. And I want to put that number into perspective. Many of you guys have heard me talk about the RVD-1000 series that we published a few years ago. And if we look at the RVD-1000 series, we see roughly 8% of patients relapsing per year. That's the way that we think about what do you lose every year with your induction therapy, roughly 8% per year. If you do the math here for Perseus, you're losing roughly 4% per year. 4% per year. Remember that number because 84% at 4 years, I'm going to show you some data in transplant ineligible later on, and I would argue many of those patients are actually transplant eligible, and it still continues to demonstrate the benefit of high-dose therapy consolidation. So just remember that 4% per year or 84% at 4 years. And again, if you look at some of these pre-specified subgroups that you'll see here, the risk group, I think the n's are so small in many of these large randomized phase threes that you don't see it in terms of the overlap with the bars here, overlap with one. But one of the things that I'll speak to that's not in this slide set is the RVD-500 that we published from our group as well. And we are seeing an improvement in PFS and OS compared to our historical controls of RVD alone, whereas here they haven't quite met the OS benefit. And I think that's because in the real world, many patients with high-risk disease don't get enrolled on trials because they can't wait long enough to really get on a randomized phase 3 trial. Whereas in our practice, if you're high risk and you see me on a Monday, you get started on therapy on a Thursday or a Friday, we're taking all of those high risks that many times won't get onto randomized trials. And I think the addition of DARA up front is having an impact on some of those high risk patients in that they're not dying or coming off study within the first few months because they're getting the benefit of daratumumab. Now, we're not seeing a difference in overall survival here, and I just want to tell you, I don't think we should see a difference in overall survival. To me, overall survival is a surrogate for access. If you're 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy, and you see an overall survival benefit, many of those patients likely were randomized in Europe, and they don't have access to these drugs off study. Whereas in the U.S., we can get most of what we need, and so I don't need a survival benefit in order to say I'm going to change my therapy. And I think that's actually a mistake we make in sort of clinical trial review and criticism. If you're 1 to 3 prior lines in myeloma and you have a median survival of 10 to 15 years, what you do in the first 6 months, unless you cure the patient, shouldn't be looked at as you have to have an overall survival benefit. That's my belief, and I'm sure we can debate that and talk about that as well. So we also know that maintenance is significantly important as well. And this was the trial that demonstrated the benefit of Len maintenance, both in terms of progression-free survival, but actually overall survival. And I think most of us have adopted the use of continuous Len maintenance for most of our patients, particularly in the post-transplant setting. And what we see in this update of the Cassiopeia trial is that if you look at DARA versus observation, and I want to make sure everybody's clear that the red curve is actually observation. It's no DARA at all in the graph on the right, and it's DARA and versus observation in the maintenance randomization. And you do see a benefit for daratumumab. Whether that benefit is as good as Len, it's hard to know. Whether that benefit is additive or synergistic with Len, we didn't have any idea until we saw the most recent trial that was presented at the IMS just a few weeks ago, which is the randomized phase 3 AURIGA trial. Now, the AURIGA trial was a trial that really took all patients, none of whom could have had DARA as their induction. So none of these patients are going to help us to answer that question. If you got DARA up front, does it matter whether you get it in the maintenance setting? But certainly many of our patients that are relapsing or are recently post-transplant may not have gotten DARA as part of their initial upfront therapy. And what I think you nicely see from AURIGA is that the addition of DARA clearly improved the depth of response. MRD times 10 to the minus 5 conversion was clear across the board. And more importantly, if you look at progression-free survival, the addition of DARA was better than Len alone. So DARA-Len versus Len alone in a DARA-naive patient population. So I think clearly for patients that have not been exposed to DARA as part of their upfront initial therapy, this is a very reasonable approach to take as a way to give them the benefit of DARA without perhaps without seeing it as part of the initial induction therapy.
Before you go on, I just want to ask Nupur how you approach first-line therapy, any situations where you're not using DARA upfront, and how are you thinking through maintenance? Are you using DARA and Len?
Yeah, so great questions. You know, in the upfront setting in 2024, I think all of us use a quadruplet, so I would incorporate daratumumab in everybody. Sagar, I'm sure, is going to show us data on the non-transplant eligible, and we can argue about their eligibility. But in my mind, everybody can get a four-drug combination. It's how you use the dosage and dosage attenuation. As far as maintenance is concerned, I don't think the AURIGA trial even really answers the question of maintenance. It's almost exposure to daratumumab, because as Sagar pointed out, these were patients who were not exposed to daratumumab before. And if you look at the Cassiopeia data, anytime you get daratumumab, your outcome is going to be better. I think what's really interesting is the Perseus trial. And if you look at the Perseus trial, there's a subset of patients, if you become MRD negative at the end of 2 years, you can actually stop daratumumab. And the question we are all going to have to ask ourselves is, when can we start thinking about doing limited duration and what that duration of daratumumab treatment is? I think that's still up in the air.
Well, I think, you know, we know we're going to need data for that, but I think what people want to know is, what are you all doing right now outside of clinical trials?
Nupur?
So I am using a four-drug combination in pretty much everybody. I am certainly continuing daratumumab for up to 2 years, sometimes up to 3 years. Beyond that, I'm not necessarily continuing dara. In the high-risk patient population, based on Sagar's data, we are using a PI and an IMID for maintenance. In the standard risk, we're just using lenalidomide maintenance right now.
And Sagar, what are you doing, and what do you think about MRD as a tool in the community?
The MRD is a harder question, so I'm going to save that one for last. In terms of what we're doing, for patients that have achieved certainly a CR after transplant, we're going with single-agent lenalidomide, and that's published in our DARA RVD 500, where you can see the series tracks almost identical with Perseus, and it does allow you the option of reusing DARA in the context of a relapse that occurs as a partner drug with something else. Whether or not there's additional benefit to adding in DARA with len in the maintenance setting, here's sort of my rationale. We know that from the RVD 1000 series, the median PFS for RVD transplant and len maintenance for a standard risk patient is 86 months. 86 months. And so there clearly is benefit for a doublet, whether it's carfilzomib on the next slide here, or whether it's DARA. But if you're truly a standard risk patient, 86 months is pretty hard to beat. And so there are certainly some toxicities for continuous DARA treatment in terms of IVIG replacement, infection risk, lack of response to vaccines. And so in those patients, I don't think the risk benefit favors the addition of DARA in the maintenance.
Just kind of curious, Nupur, what were you telling people with standard risk disease, median survival would be 5 years ago compared to now?
Yeah, no, we have more than doubled or trebled, yeah. I would say, yeah. In the standard risk. And it's a standard risk patient who we will actually cure. And those are the patients why, you know, we haven't talked about risk stratification, but yeah. I'm of the opinion that even the standard risk patients should get the best possible treatment yes. up front. And I am not going to just do four drugs on the high right. risk, but this is the patient population which is going to get cured, yeah. and their median survival is well into the teens right now, Neil. Yeah. They're doing really well.
I guess it's hard to talk about, you know, survival 10, 12 years now, because, you know, your patients are getting trials that are pushing that out. By the yeah. time they get to 12 years,
that's
there'll
right.
be other therapies, but really amazing story. All right, let's keep going.
All right, so again, this is a testament for the use of doublet maintenance using DARA with LEN. And as I mentioned before, we know that there is some data from the FORTE trial that suggests the addition of carfilzomib with lenalidomide does offer significant benefit in the standard risk, in the high risk, and in the double hit group. Again, for me, it's what's the risk-benefit ratio of two drugs versus one. In the high risk and the double hit, I think it's pretty clear. That's easy for me to sell. In the standard risk, I'm not quite so sure yet, because they do so remarkably well. And that 86 months that I mentioned for single agent len with standard risk in our RVD 1000, that is likely closer to 140 or 150 months in the DRVD upfront arm. So it's only going to get better and may even be a doubling of the expected progression-free survival.
And you guys need to start talking about years and not months. I can't even calculate it.
Yeah. Well, I had to get Dr. Nook and our group to stop putting weeks at the bottom of this thing. So months is a big step forward for us. So let's switch gears a little bit to newly diagnosed transplant ineligible. And I just want to tell you, and this is my caveat, and Nupur can disagree with me, but all of the trials that I'm about to show you excluded frail patients. That was actually an exclusion criteria. So this was in Europe, where if you're over the age of 65, you can't get a transplant, whereas we know that at least half, if not more, of these patients in the U.S. likely would have been transplant eligible. And in my mind, the question I ask when I see this data, and I want you all to have this in your head, is how do you approach a frail patient, a truly frail patient? Because I think that's a different set of discussions than much of the data that I'm about to show you in the next few slides. So you all probably saw this as well. The FDA approved isatuximab in combination with VRd for newly diagnosed myeloma. That really was based on the IMROSE trial. IMROSE, again, was a randomized phase 3 trial of ESA VRD versus VRD. Again, no transplant as part of this. And what they very nicely demonstrated, that the response rate, the MRD negativity rate, whether you use 10 to the minus 5 or you use 10 to the minus 6, sustained MRD negativity, all of the metrics were clearly better with the addition of isatuximab over just VRD alone. And I think this speaks what Dr. Raji was saying just a moment ago, which is quad should be used in almost every patient up front. And I would argue, except perhaps the frail, because this doesn't really answer that question. None of these patients were actually frail. And if you look at the progression-free survival, what you'll see here, clear benefit for the quadruplet over the triplet. So big difference in progression-free survival. And in fact, at 60 months, 66% of patients were still in remission at 5 years. Now, remember, at 48 months in Perseus, it was 84%. So it's roughly a 25 to 30% reduction in the PFS by pulling the transplant out. And that's why I make such a big deal about the fact that many of these patients likely were transplant eligible, and had you put them on a quad, transplanted them, and then talked about risk-adapted maintenance, that PFS curve may actually be higher. But there are many patients who don't want to do or talk about a transplant in this age set, and at least now you have some data on what they can look like with a quad if they're fit going forward.
Just curious from Newport, what's going on with sub-Q ESA? Is that coming?
Yeah, sub-Q ESA is coming. Certainly in the context of trials, we're going to start doing a relapse trial where we're using the on-body device for the first time in the United States. And I think once you get the subcutaneous isatuximab, that will in fact have us use it more. As of right now, the IV is a little bit of a limitation.
What, this is a device? Like, how does it work? What do you do?
So, you know, you actually just stick, so it's a preloaded little bottle which you insert into that device. That device is clapped onto your belly. And the benefit of that really is, if you think about daratumumab, it is injected and the nurse has to be there for about 15 minutes while the dara goes into the belly. In this case, the nurse presses the button and can walk away. You know, in the future, our hope is that these on-body devices can be used at home. We'll see if that happens, but that's how we should be thinking about it.
So I love looking at trial names, and I like the idea of benefit.
Yeah, so this was an interesting trial from the French group trying to answer the question about ESA-VRD versus ESA-RD, so quad versus triplet, as Nupur raised earlier. Again, frail patients were excluded. And so that to me, that's the question I want to know for a frail patient. Can you give a quadruplet safely? I'm pretty confident that Nupur probably can. I don't know that everybody can. And so I think that this is an important question to answer. And what he showed across the board was that clearly four drugs were better than three in terms of MRD negativity, which was the primary endpoint at 18 months. We now know that the FDA is accepting MRD negativity as a surrogate for clinical benefit, as long as you're continuing to follow patients for PFS and OS, and the benefit trial will do that. But this really speaks to the question of, in a fit patient, is four drugs better than three? And the answer is pretty clearly yes. There is no difference yet in progression-free survival, and there is no big difference as yet in terms of overall survival, but the primary endpoint of this trial was MRD negativity at 18 months, and as I showed you on the last slide, clearly favors the use of a quadruplet over a triplet. Now, the last trial that we're going to talk about that really speaks to this concept of four versus three was the Cepheus trial. And this is new data that was just presented a few weeks ago in Brazil at the IMS meeting. And again, this is basically Perseus without the transplant. So VRD, RD, consolidation and maintenance versus DARA-VRD versus DARA-R as maintenance therapy. So it's again, exactly the same, pretty much identical to IMROS in terms of the patient population. And again, frail patients were excluded from this trial as well. And so what you see is the response rate clearly higher in the group that got DARA. I don't think anybody's surprised by this information anymore. Again, DARA plus anything is better than anything. And you see that not just in terms of overall response rate. You see that in greater than CR rate. You see that in MRD negativity. And if you begin to look at the PFS, you can see here at 54 months, it's in the 60s compared to only in the 40s for patients who got VRD. So a clear difference in progression-free survival favoring the quad over the triplet. There is not yet any difference in overall survival. And the one group that I would say I think overall survival is not unreasonable. I won't say it's reasonable, but it's not unreasonable, is in the older, frail patient where they may not get a shot at salvage therapy. You may lose more patients, attrition, between first and second line therapy in the older, frailer patient than I think you do in the younger, fit patient. Now, as we've said, we've done great work in terms of improving the progression-free survival for patients, and hopefully now you'll be able to see your myeloma patients less and less frequently, but the reality is still that a significant fraction of them will ultimately relapse at some point. And this is an older trial that I think is getting a lot of play, especially with the use of Dara-Len as maintenance therapy. We now have an alternative salvage therapy using bortezomib in combination with selinexor. And this is using weekly bortezomib and weekly selinexor. And as you can see, in terms of progression-free survival, this clearly does offer benefit over bortezomib and dexamethasone alone. It does come in the form of a triplet versus a doublet. And you don't necessarily have to go back to something that you've used and the patient has been resistant to in the past. And this, in many ways, is being used not just as a salvage, but potentially as a bridge to CAR-T. And I'm sure that Nupur is going to talk to us about CAR and first relapse. And how do you get there? What are the logistics? This is one regimen you can use to try and get there.
So before we go on to Nupur, you know there's one question I have to ask you after that talk, which of course is, do you think the Falcons are going to get to the playoffs? No, not really. But,
they are. They are.
I think so. But no, I would like to know how you would define truly frail, maybe give an example from your practice, and what do you do?
Yeah, you know, there are lots of complicated frailty indices, most of which are far too complicated for me to figure out how to use in my daily practice. I really look at a patient, and if they have trouble completing their ADLs, they tell me they can't really walk, they can't cook for themselves, they can't do routine things, that's somebody that I think is frail. The other one that is more intuition is cardiovascular risk. And sometimes you walk into a room and they tell you they've had an MI 3 years ago and they may have had a stroke. That to me is a sign that this patient is perhaps more frail than we know. And what we're going to do to them is going to unmask that. And I don't want to unmask that.
So how do you treat patients like that?
For the truly frail, I actually give them DRD. I think it's hard to beat DRD in that context. And it's a triplet, but I think DRD does so well. And in the Maya trial, they did, in fact, enroll frail patients. And so I think it does answer an important question.
Would you like to comment on this?
No, I have to say that we do use 4 drugs. What I will use in a frail patient is RVD light with daratumumab added on. You dose reduce Revlimid, you give the bortezomib weekly, and it's in general well tolerated. I will tell you that we've just completed the Alliance trial. This is for the truly elderly frail patient population, and what we've used out there is a 4 drug combination again. It's Dara with IRD. So ixazomib, those of you who've forgotten about ixazomib, it still exists, lenalidomide and dexamethasone. I will say that RVD light is way better tolerated because the Dara IRD, although we are able to keep patients on it, the issue is we are giving 3 oral drugs. And in this elderly patient population where there's polypharmacy involved, we've really had our nursing really walk patients through that, and that can be a challenge, which is why I love Dara RVD Lite. It works really well.
All right, let's talk about CAR-T bispecifics.
Okay, switching gears now. Obviously, done a lot in the upfront setting, but I'm going to talk about CARs and bispecifics and absolutely mention the antibody drug conjugate as well. So you all know that we have 2 CAR products approved in the context of myeloma. We have Ide-cel or Ide-captogene viclucil and Cilta-cel, both of them targeting BCMA, slight differences in the constructs and slight differences in how they tend to expand. Cilta-cel has a biepitopic binding. Ide-cel was approved initially, accelerated approval based on this KarMMa trial, 128 patients at the recommended phase 2 dose, 80%+ overall response rate in very heavily pretreated patients, which translated into a PFS of about 20 months if they achieved a complete response. And about 22% of these patients actually achieved MRD negativity. Switching now to cilta-cel, this is approved based on a phase 2 trial, CARTITUDE 1, 97 patients. The big difference between ide-cel and cilta-cel, the response rates are lower. Out here, you'll see MRD negativity in about 55% of patients. So there you have 22%, here you have a doubling of the MRD negativity. And what cilta-cel does is results in a PFS of about 34 months with an overall median survival which has not yet been reached. Now, if you look at the toxicity, the good news is the acute toxicities didn't see a lot of difference. You see CRS or cytokine release syndrome in pretty much all patients, but grade 3 and 4 was seen in about 5% only. You do see ICANS in both, that is the immune effector cell-mediated acute neurotoxicity, and that is, again, very comparable. What is a little bit different between the two drug products is delayed neurotoxicity. I think we should get rid of the word none out there, because as we're using more ide-cel, we're seeing it, but definitely less frequent. But with cilta-cel, we have seen at the back end when we treat these patients an incidence of about 9% of delayed neurotoxicity. This is movement like disorders, cranial nerve palsies, etc.
Before you go on, just kind of curious, in the past, Sagar, I'd ask, if you have your choice of CAR T, which one would you prefer? And people would say, well, we don't have, you just take whatever you can get because it was very difficult. Are we still in that situation? Do we now have a choice? And if so, how do you make that decision?
Yeah, I mean, I think manufacturing is not really an issue for either one. For us, it's access to apheresis slots, so how quickly can we get them on the machine? And for us, for a majority, we're using cilta-cel.
And same question to you, Newport. Any more comments about the delayed neuro syndrome and more detail? When does it develop? And it's like movement. Is it like Parkinson's? What do you see?
So it's almost like a Parkinsonian-like syndrome, but typically this is the neurotoxicity which occurs 1 month out. So most of these patients are 4 weeks out from their CAR T cells. I will tell you, as we've started using more cilta-cel, we are seeing a little bit more of this. And the challenge with this patient population is it is very difficult to treat and very difficult to reverse. It does associate with an increase in the absolute lymphocyte count. I certainly have given high-dose Cytoxan in these patients to shut the CARs down, and some of my patients have gotten better. It could just be a mood or affect disorder. We've seen your weakness, myopathy, as well as neurotoxicity in terms of neuropathy, as well as cranial nerve palsies. These patients end up being on steroids for a long time, and we do use anakinra, and they tend to be a little more immunocompromised. And the question which Sagar answered of what do you use more, cilta-cel or ide-cel, I will tell you, at Mass General, we have access to both equally, but we use both. And one of the reasons maybe we do have a trial with ide-cel, because part of the reason why I wanted to show you the differences between KARMA as well as CARTITUDE is the big difference is the MRD negative rate. And if you are MRD negative, your outcomes are quite similar. So what we are doing right now with patients who go standard of care ide-cel, they're getting 6 months of consolidation with a bispecific to try and improve on that MRD negative rate and then see a better outcome. We'll see if that pans out.
Sagar, any ideas about why cilta-cel might be more effective in terms of mechanisms?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is hitched to this dual binding epitope, and that might get you more mileage, if you will. I mean, the half-life of cilta-cel is actually shorter than ide-cel, and so my big thing is persistence. That's why I think we ultimately fail with CARs, is because they don't last as long as the CD19 CARs do. In lymphoma, for instance, where they're there forever, in myeloma, they go away at about 6 to 12 months. Which is why I think we do see those relapses. But I think that the idea that Newper's in bringing in is, before CAR, the attraction was one and done. Well, the reality is most of us are not doing one and done. At least at my place, they all get about 9 months worth of pomalidomide if their counts are okay, with the goal of keeping the T cell awake. That's the purpose. It sort of rejuvenates that T cell, if you will. I've done it in about 30 patients. I don't know what the outcomes are, but certainly I think it's a, and you're giving a bispecific consolidation, which makes great sense to me.
So we actually, I actually did a two-hour program on desmoid tumors recently, if you can believe that. And when we were talking about nirogacestat, and we brought up the fact that I think you looked at that in myeloma.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Yeah, you know, with Belamaf, that's where the trial has really been done. It did look like you could give a lower dose of Belamaf, which, you know, I think you may cover Belamaf later on. If you give a lower dose, you may reduce the ocular issues.
But what does it do? It makes the BCMA more enhanced? Or what?
Yeah, so it's a GSI. So GSI is the enzyme that cleaves BCMA off the surface of the cell. So it drops soluble BCMA, and it expresses BCMA more on the surface of the cell.
Interesting. All right, let's talk about CAR T and earlier therapy.
So moving to earlier lines, this was the confirmatory registration trial, KarMMa 3, ide-cel versus standard of care. These were patients who had 2 to 4 lines of treatment. What I want to highlight here is 95% of these were Dara refractory. And if you look at the responses, obviously the CAR T cells was better compared to standard of care, translated into a better PFS as well, about 14.4 months versus just about 3 months. And 3 months is what you would see in the 95% Dara refractory patients. It's almost like the mammoth patient population that we've been used to setting that as our bar going forward. This was CARTITUDE 4, similar design, just the difference here is it's a much earlier line of treatment. This is cilta-cel versus just DPD or PVD. And again, if you look at the baseline characteristics here, Dara refractoriness was only seen in 23%. So, you know, we love to compare KarMMa 3 with CARTITUDE 4, but I think it's really important to take a step back here and understand that this was a really different patient population. Mm-hmm. And basically, you had to have been len refractory to be able to get cilta-cel out here. Again, very high response rates. Remember, when you have registration trials like these are intent to treat analysis, so everybody's included. So you will see a little bit of a dropout rate in terms of responses. The PFS obviously really quite good in favor of the CAR T cells. And again, underscoring the fact that if you've had less treatment, your PFS is much better, as you can see on the right-hand side of the curves there. Now, if you look at the overall survival, this overall survival data was updated at the Myeloma Society meeting in Brazil, and you see at 30 months, about 76% of patients who got cilta-cel are alive versus 63% of patients who got standard of care. Obviously, no CAR T cell talk is complete without talking about second cancers. And the FDA did, warn all of us, and they wanted us to go back and look at our second cancer rate. And this is data from Penn. And what they did here was took more than 500 patients, and these patients had either a CAR for their lymphoma, a CD19-directed CAR, or a BCMA-directed CAR for their myeloma, and then they looked at the incidence of second cancers. If you look at the number of solid cancers, it was about 12. If you look at hematologic cancers, it was 5. And if you look back at the subgroups there, most of them were not T-cell related except 1. Having said this, since this publication, there have been 2 case reports, one from the Dana-Farber, where they found a GI T-cell lymphoma and actually did see the CAR construct within those lymphoid cells. And similarly, there's a report from Australia as well for a patient who'd got cilta-cel who did have CAR insert in their T-cell lymphoma. That specific patient also had clonal hematopoiesis, so the risk does exist. I think it's a really low risk. We are using a genomically modified T-cell, and the rates of genetic insertion that we are seeing, in my mind, is so low, and the benefits of CARs is so high. So because of this risk, I think counseling a patient is important, but preventing them from getting this, probably not. Switching gears now to bispecifics.
Before you go on, I just want to mention, I should have mentioned in the lymphoma module, but I think you might find this interesting. I was doing a program with Steve Horowitz from Memorial, who's the T-cell lymphoma expert, and I asked him about these T-cell lymphomas, and he was really talking more about those in patients with diffuse large B-cell. But he thought that a lot of these cases could be the fact they have underlying angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma that just gets exposed when you kill the other lymphoma cells. Any thoughts about that type of explanation, or do you think it's actually the CAR T being inserted?
So in a couple of patients, these two, for example, CAR was inserted, but he's right. What we have looked at is the incidence of clonal hematopoiesis or chip-like signatures in myeloma patients. Myeloma is a disease of older patients. You know, second cancers is not something new that we talk about in the myeloma world. We've been talking about it, Sagar, since transplant days and lenalidomide maintenance.
Sure.
And we used to argue about, should we use len maintenance in those patients? And we said, well, the risk of MDS and leukemia is about 3%. I do think, you know, CHIP predisposes patients, but the incidence of CHIP in myeloma is really high. Mm-hmm. It's close to 40 or 50%. The incidence of these cancers is about 1 or 2%. So because of CHIP, can you use CHIP as a way of figuring out whether you could get a CAR? The answer is probably not, but just again, right. Counseling a patient is important.
And there is one analysis that suggests that patients with CHIP and myeloma actually have a better outcome. Hmm. So I just don't think we know the story.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Agreed completely. So switching gears now to bispecifics. This is the laundry list of bispecifics. A couple of them have fallen off this table, so alnuctamab is not being developed any further. But the two approved drug products we have right now are teclistamab and elranatamab. They are bispecific so that they target CD3 as well as BCMA, and they are off the shelf. And this was what got Tech approved. This was the MajesTEC-1 trial, 165 patients. I think important to remember, there's been a theme all morning. You saw, lymphoma, very similar data. You have step-up dosing for this, where you use a small little dose at the beginning, then 0.3 and 1.5 mgs. And at least the requirement for the step-up dosing right now per label is hospitalization for the first 48 hours. I think all of us at our centers, Sagar, you're doing this where you're giving them outpatient. We have the BOSS protocol where you're using it outpatient as well to see if we can safely give these. The response rate's a little bit lower than CAR T cells, but pretty robust, about 63%. And the median PFS of teclistamab is about a little short of 12 months. The big toxicity with the CAR bispecifics is early on. You will see CRS, hardly any ICANS. It usually happens the step-up dosing as well as week 2. Beyond that, to see CRS is extremely rare. I think the biggest challenge that we are finding with bispecifics is the infectious risk that we are seeing with these patients over the course of their treatment. Similarly, elranatamab has been approved in exactly the same space. Overall response rate very similar. The PFS at 15 months, though, is median not yet reached. And if they achieve MRD negativity, which is in about 30% of patients, they're the ones who have a PFS of close to 90%. So really quite remarkable data. We have a third one now. This is Linvo, not yet approved, and hopefully will get approved, higher response rate. The reason I bring this up is it doesn't have the same step-up dosing as Tec and Elra does. This is once a week intravenous dosing and no hospitalization required. And again, the durability of response with Linvo seems quite good. So if it gets approved, we'll see whether or not people use Linvo over Tech and Elra.
Before you go on, any way to separate out the BCMA bispecifics in terms of efficacy, tolerability?
You know, it's hard to compare, and I hate doing that across trials. All of them were pretty, if you look at the response rates, quite similar. People argue that Elra may be better. I don't like to do those arguments, and you're never going to compare them head to head. End of the day, I think whatever y'all are used to using, at our site, we have everything available, but in a community oncologist's office, you're not going to have both drug products, so whatever you have is what I would use.
So Sagar, you may have heard the lymphoma faculty talking about the issue of bispecifics in the community. I'm curious where that stands right now. Myeloma, yeah. Do you foresee a situation where it's going to get started in the community?
Yeah, so, you know, I was intrigued to hear that discussion earlier on. So we at our center actually have published now on our series of giving everybody getting a bispecific preemptive tocilizumab, and we've reduced that CRS rate from 72% that you saw for TEC down to about 18 to 22%. And we do three quarters of ours as an outpatient. And the reasons that we won't do it as an outpatient are the tumor burden is so high, we're worried that even that one dose of preemptive toci is not enough, or they don't have a good caregiver. If they don't have a good caregiver that could bring them in should something happen, we'll do the step up in the hospital. But in general, we're doing a significant fraction of all of our bispecifics out with one dose of preemptive toci.
Nupur, what about in the community?
So in the community, they're not yet doing step-up dosing. We do the step-up dosing and then send the patient to the community oncologist. And the way we choose between ELRA and TEC, if we've had a referral, we talk to the physician and say, what do you have available? And that's what we end up starting. In terms of tocilizumab, I just want to pick up on that. So we do not use tocilizumab in everybody. What we are doing in that first week of outpatient bispecific is we're actually giving them dexamethasone pretty much throughout that first week, and by doing that, you can actually really decrease the CRS issues. I do think TOCI prophylactic is a good idea in the subset of patients who have a high disease burden, high ferritin levels, etc. Those right now we are hospitalizing.
I was just flashing Sagar. A couple years ago, we were doing a bunch of videos of myeloma patients. I interviewed this patient who had been on teclistamab for 2 years, doing great, no side effects and response. And the day I did the interview was the day it was approved.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of use that as an example. Yeah. I have heard so many patients from you over the years who went from trial to trial.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the real question is not going to be how do we give this as an outpatient? How do we give this in the community? To me, the real question, and we have a paper under review that addresses that, is what's the real frequency of dosing? Because even getting to once a month dosing, which I think you're doing, we're trying to do it as quickly as we can. Even then, 80% of the T cells are still bound by the antibody and are basically dysfunctional. And so how do we make that infection bridge in a way that still maintains efficacy but doesn't lead to things like T-cell exhaustion?
Please continue.
For sure. So switching gears now to talquetamab. This is the other bispecific which targets the protein GPCR5D. High response rates. And if you look at the toxicity, a little bit different from BCMA-directed drug products. And what you see out here is less in terms of infections, but you do see dysgeusia, you see significant weight loss in these patients, skin and nail-related changes. And these are all on-target, off-tumor toxicities of talquetamab. And it can be quite a challenge to give talquetamabs to our patients. I do want to talk about Belimumab. You know, Sagar, you've done a lot of the development of Belimumab, and I really like to call it the comeback kid. Is this going to be the comeback kid? And I think we have to start acknowledging that Belimumab is going to be accessible and available. What Belimumab is, belantamab mafodotin, is an antibody drug conjugate targeting BCMA. It was taken off by the FDA because the phase 3 trial did not kind of meet its statistical endpoint. I do think it was a little premature for the regulators to take it off the market because it was just the p-value was not sufficient enough. There was no new toxicity signal, and they knew that there were two more trials coming down the pike, and these were the two trials. So this was DREAM 7. This is bortezomib. Belimumab, bortezomib, and dexamethasone versus daratumumab, bortezomib, and dexamethasone. And this is for the first time we are seeing an anti-BCMA pitched against an anti-CD38. And if you look at the progression-free survival, there's a trebling of the progression-free survival, 68% versus 43% at about 18 months. Absolutely remarkable, and that's why I do think this is going to end up being used in the future. Similarly, we have data from the DREAM 8 trial, and in this case, it was pomalidomide with Belimumab versus pomalidomide, bortezomib, dexamethasone. Again, PFS of 71% versus 51%. I think the biggest challenge we have with Belimumab, and Sagar can speak to that, is the ocular toxicity, and you've already talked a little bit about nigrostat. Once you dose reduce Belimumab and give it less frequently, it's actually extremely well tolerated. The benefits of a drug product like Belimumab is no step-up dosing, off-the-shelf downside ocular toxicity, and we'll have to see how that pans out in the future.
So Sagar, about the same time I did the video with the patient, I did another video. It was about the time that Belamef was taken off the market. This is a patient who had been on Belamef for 4 years.
Yeah.
So can you kind of, and we were kind of cranking along before that, and we did a whole program on ophthalmic issues in oncology, if you can imagine. So can you kind of bring us back to where we were before in terms of how to use this drug? And I'm curious, like, where are you going to use it?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And I know that those of us who use the drug a lot saw those really long responders. And what we learned from those patients was that less is actually more. And that was actually the title of my discussion at ASCO, less is more. And the idea that we don't need to stick to that three-week cycle. And in fact, what has been done by Turpos in the Greek myeloma group is giving it every 8 or 12 weeks and pairing ophthalmologic views with patient-reported changes in vision. And what he showed was that if a patient tells you they had no changes in vision, they didn't need to see the ophthalmologist. If they had mild blurry vision for a few days, they didn't need to see the ophthalmologist. And if you look at both DREAM 7 and DREAM 8, which I think is coming up next, the average interval between dosing of Belamef, not what was dictated by the trial, but what was actually given, is every 8 to 12 weeks. So if it comes back, I suspect it's going to come back with an every 8 to 12 week dosing schedule with and maybe without ophthalmologic exams, which makes it so easy for a patient. And 36 months is as good as a car, right?
So what was DREAM 8? Because I don't think we have a slide on it.
That's DREAM 8.
Oh, that one's okay.
That's
sorry.
DREAM 8.
Sorry, okay, we got it.
He wasn't paying attention.
Well, I just said it was coming
up. Having too much fun in Disney World.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, keep going.
All right. So obviously questions, you know, we are moving these therapies earlier. The question is going to be about sequencing. The question is going to be how long should we treat and what are the combinations that we should be using? A couple of slides on sequencing, and I will tell you that this data is going to change, right? This was the way we had the data right now because of the timing of how these drug products were developed. But what you see out here is data from Ide-cel and Cilta-cel. And the bottom line here is if you've had a prior BCMA-directed strategy, whether it's Belamef, whether it's one of the bispecifics, your outcomes post the CAR T-cells are not great. So if you're really thinking about a CAR T-cell, do not use the same antigen to target prior to the CAR T-cell. Certainly do not use the bispecific because we are going to have T-cell exhaustion and not create good CAR T-cells. The converse, however, is not true. So if you've had CAR T-cells and then relapse, the majority of patients will still have BCMA. And in those patients, you can actually use a bispecific. In this case, on one side, you have TEC data. On the other side, you have ELRA data. And whichever bispecific you use, you're still going to see a response. I do think the reason I'm saying this is all going to evolve and all going to change is we are not going to be using these drug products the way we are. We're not going to be using the bispecifics forever. And I use the analogy of an anti-CD38 monoclonal antibody. When we first used daratumumab, you know, we didn't know whether we could use it again. And Sagar, you brought this up early. What we've learned is when you have an antibody targeting an antigen, if they've been off that drug for about 6 months or so, you will see antigen re-expression. I think we need to study whether T-cells will become functional after bispecific and what that washout period is. And therefore, whatever we talk about sequencing, hopefully will change when we talk at this meeting again next year. So the challenge is, again, moving therapies earlier can, in fact, impact therapies later. And I think sequencing and maintenance is going to become an issue. And with early, Sagar, you already brought this out, and you talked about using pomalidomide. You know, we've always said with CAR T cells, it's one and done. But as we move them early, is it really one and done, or are we using something else at the back end? And the question is going to be, can we be combining some of these? And at least at my center, we're already doing that somewhat. So in my mind, questions over the next 5 years, can we use fixed duration? And I do think this is probably the unmet need in myeloma, where fixed duration of treatment should be based on MRD. We're doing some of those studies. The University of Chicago is doing a nice MRD stop study. We have a bunch of other studies similar. And getting rid of treatment in at least a subset of patients is going to help us define what cure in myeloma is. Can we use immunotherapy early and replace transplant? Well, we are doing that study already, CARTITUDE 6, we shall see. Can we use risk-adapted approaches? And in my mind, for me, risk-adapted should be mostly in the maintenance setting. Can we combine TCRs? That's already happening. And where will Belimumab fit? I think the next few years will figure that out. And will we compare CARs versus bispecifics? And for me, you know, I don't think it's about comparing two. We have two really great drug products. Why pitch them against each other? But can we think about using them in combination or in sequence, and we're already doing it at MGH for sure.
So a few practical questions here. One, and we talked about bispecific in the community, Sagar, but what about the issue of infection? I hear more and more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think IVIG prophylaxis is one thing. We actually presented data at IMS looking at CMV reactivation in about 100 patients who got bispecifics, and we showed that about 25 to 30% actually did reactivate CMV, but only 4 patients actually needed to be treated. So I think it's one of those where you just got to get comfortable checking the lab and feeling comfortable sitting tight, because most of them with IVIG replacement will suppress themselves, but a few may need more than that.
So Nupur, post CAR T bispecific, BCMA or GCBD or talquetamab? What type of bispecific do you go to after CAR T?
So, you know, if they've had a long remission duration post the CAR T cell, I'm very comfortable using a BCMA after a BCMA. Mm-hmm. If the relapse is very quick, and I think for the future, when we start doing our genomic studies, we should be looking at GPRC5D expression. We should be looking at FCRH5 as well as BCMA. In those who've had no response to BCMA, we look to see, and that's when I would change the target.
Mm-hmm. More questions from the audience. Sagar, isotuximab after patients in patients who had prior Dara.
So at least my anecdotal experience, and I know that there's data looking at Dara after ESA and ESA after Dara, they are basically functionally the same. So if a patient is truly resistant to Dara, I don't think you're going to get any mileage out of ESA.
Getting back to belantamab, Sagar, what's the optimal partner?
Well, I mean, I think the IMID, because I'm a big IMID immunotherapy fan, so that makes the most sense to me, but the bortezomib data look pretty good too.
So what about cell mods, Nupur? You know, I've been hearing about them for so long, yet they're not here yet. What's going on?
Yeah, no, hopefully they will be coming to a clinic to you soon, but we're still going through the development. So we have iberdomide and mezigdomide. Sagar, you've been very involved with the development of all of this. They are getting, you know, the Excalibur studies are sort of their confirmatory registration trials, which are ongoing as we speak. I think the beauty of these cell mods are they're extremely potent. So they're the next lenalidomide and pomalidomide, but several fold more potent. And the nice thing about these are oral, so they're very easy to combine with our T-cell redirected treatments and augment the effect of these TCRs. So I'm excited about them.
We'll Any see comments about cell mods? Why are they more effective?
Well, why are they more effective? I think they were engineered to bind better, and they're actually engineered to activate T cells more. So the longest responder I've got on a CAR is somebody that got Ide-cel and then had Iber maintenance afterwards. And those patients do remarkably well, because I think it's like, I say, cappuccino for T cells.
Cappuccino for T cells. I think that's a good thought and a good way to end here. I want to thank the faculty. Thank you for attending. Have a great day and have a great retreat here. Thank you so much.